y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey y'all, I'm Mandy.
And this is Monstrous.
This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering for some. Listener discretion is advised.
All right, we're on our third case for Women's Appreciation Month, and you're going to love this one, just like you liked.
I don't know, that last one was pretty good.
I know, this one's really good too. I dove hard into this one.
Down a rabbit hole?
Oh yeah, I read a book and everything.
Oh nice.
Yep, I went down the rabbit hole in this one. This one captures the strength and the determination that women embody. It showcases the struggles that we as women still face today when it comes to being seen and understood as more than frail, emotional, and weak beings. For this week's case, I'm going to tell you about a woman that fought against social norms and built a name for herself during a time when women were to be seen and not heard. She was a pioneer, and she paved the road for the women that came after her. She showed women were not just for having babies and cleaning house, that they were strong, independent, and intelligent. Today, I'm going to tell you about Nellie Bly, a woman who is a force and shook the world around her. So, before I dive into her story, I want to say I don't speak for all women, of course. But for myself, Nellie Bly is inspiring. As someone who grew up being told by many people around me that I wouldn't amount to anything, that I would go nowhere in life, and so on, due to many factors, and then having to fight for everything that I have today, to be more and to prove everyone wrong, she gives inspiration and hope that that is possible. That no matter where you're from or the hurdles that are put in front of us, we can accomplish the same as men and more. And I think the lesson that we can all take away from her story is that no matter your gender, if you want something, all you need to do is put in the work, fight for it, and never give up on it. So, Elizabeth Cochran Seaman, better known by her pen name, Nellie Bly, was born on May 5th, 1864, in Cochran Mills. Cochran Mills is now part of Burrell Township in Armstrong County, Pennsylvania. Her father was Michael Cochran, who was born around 1810. He began his career as a laborer and mill worker before he bought that mill and then land for his family, and later became a merchant postmaster along with the associate justice. So her dad's just all over the place.
Yeah.
He then later became what was considered at the time to be a wealthy man. Michael Cochran married twice in his life. He had 10 children with his first wife, Catherine Murphy.
Damn.
And then 5 more with his second wife, Mary Jane Kennedy.
Shit. Right? He was busy.
I know. These 5 additional children included Elizabeth, who was Michael's 13th daughter. So he had 15 kids total. 13 of them were girls.
No way.
I would not have wanted to be in that house.
No.
So unfortunately, I couldn't really find anything about her mom, other than Mary Jane was born on December 29th, 1829 in Pennsylvania, and that she died February 26, 1921 in New York. She had no other children than the 5 that she had with Michael Cochran, despite the fact that she would go on to marry twice following his death. So in 1870, when Elizabeth was 6, her father, Michael Cochran, died unexpectedly without a will. Her mother was unable to keep the land that her father owned due to the greediness of his older children from his first wife. So her mom and her other siblings had to leave Cochran's mill. After this, Elizabeth's mother remarried, but in 1878, despite the societal norms of the time, she divorced her husband due to severe abuse. Once Elizabeth became a teenager, she wanted to be seen as more sophisticated woman. As a child, her mother had nicknamed her Pinky. Her mom often dressed her in like this cute little pink dress. So the nickname fit. But being a teenager and all grown up now, she dropped that nickname and then changed her last name from Cochran without an E to Cochran with an E. I don't know why that's so significant. But the E, I guess, made it sophisticated. I don't know. So in 1879, when she was 16, Elizabeth enrolled at Indiana's Normal School, which is now Indiana University of Pennsylvania. She attended school for one term, but she ended up having to drop out before taking her final exams once it was revealed that she did not have the funds to complete school and graduate. In 1880, Mary Jane moved her children that were still at home, which included Elizabeth, to, I don't know how to say this, Allegheny City? I think it's how you say it. Let's look it up. Here we go.
Allegheny.
Allegheny City. Which is now the city of Pittsburgh. So in 1885, the Pittsburgh Dispatch, which was a newspaper, came out with a column titled, What Are Girls Good For? This column stated that girls were primarily for birthing children and keeping house. Which, you can fuck off, my guy.
Yeah, that's fucked up.
This column prompted Elizabeth to write in a response under the pseudonym Lonely Orphan Girl. The paper's editor, George Madden, was impressed with the passion that she showed. George ran an advertisement asking for the lonely orphan girl to reveal herself. When Elizabeth met with the editor, he offered her the opportunity to write a piece for the newspaper. Her first article for the Dispatch, which she wrote under the same pseudonym as before, was titled The Girl Puzzle, and it argued that not all women get married and that better jobs were needed for women, which, fact. Her second article, titled Mad Marriages, discussed how divorce affected women, and she argued for divorce reform laws. This second article is when her pen name, Nellie Bly, was born. So from here on out, I'm going to refer to her as Nellie to avoid any kind of confusion. So during this time, it was pretty normal for women journalists to use pen names to conceal their gender, because otherwise readers were going to discredit their work, you know, oh, it's just a woman, you know.
Right.
So this pen name was not chosen by Nellie. It was chosen by her editor. And the name was inspired by the title character of a popular song by Stephen Foster titled Nellie Bly. And the name was originally supposed to be spelled N-E-L-L-Y. But the editor of the Dispatch had made a mistake spelling it N-E-L-L-I-E. And it just kind of stuck. So following this second article and the success of it, she was offered a full-time job. In the start of her career at the Dispatch, Nellie focused on the lives of working women. She wrote a series of investigative articles on female factory workers. But the newspaper had received a number of complaints from factory owners. And Nellie was then moved from the women's pages to cover fashion, society, and gardening, which were normal roles for women in this career at the time. But she found it very dissatisfying. So this time, Nellie was only 21, and she was determined to do what no girl or woman had ever done before. She decided to travel to Mexico to serve as a foreign correspondent. She spent about 6 months reporting on the lives and customs of the Mexican people. In one of these reports, Nellie had protested the imprisonment of a local journalist that had criticized the Mexican government that at that time was under the dictatorship, I'm going to say this wrong, of Porfirio Diaz. I know I said that wrong. That's as good as I got. So this report led to Nellie being threatened with arrest, which had prompted her to flee the country. Each of these reports were later written into a book titled 6 Months in Mexico. Once Nellie returned home in the U.S., she accused Diaz of being a tyrannical ruler who was suppressing the people of Mexico and controlling the press. Back at the Pittsburgh Dispatch, Nellie found herself once again writing about the theater and the arts, and she hated it. So, in 1887, she left the Dispatch and Pittsburgh for New York. Once in New York, she faced rejection after rejection, as newspapers would not consider hiring her because she was a woman.
Of course.
Yeah. After 4 months and now penniless, she managed to talk her way into the offices of Joseph Pulitzer, like the Pulitzer Prize, Joseph Pulitzer. Mm-hmm. He owned a newspaper called the New York World. She wanted to write a piece on the immigrant experience in the U.S., but Joseph denied that story. Instead, he challenged Nellie. She was given the chance to prove herself, and she was up to the task. She agreed to take on an undercover assignment in which she would fake insanity to get into and investigate reports on the brutality and neglect at the Women's Lunatic Asylum on Blackwell's Island, which is now named Roosevelt Island. This was not an easy task for Nellie to achieve. To do this, she decided to check herself into a boarding house called Temporary Homes for Females. In order to achieve the look, she stayed up all night and began to make accusations that other boarders were insane to appear as a disturbed woman. Nellie would refuse to go to bed and eventually scared so many of the boarders that the police were called and they took her to the courthouse. Once there, she was examined by a police officer, a judge, and a doctor. Nellie was then taken to Bellevue Hospital for a few days. Then, after further evaluation, Nellie was placed on a boat and taken to Blackwell's Island.
Nice.
Once committed into the asylum, Nellie experienced the horrific conditions of the Women's Lunatic Asylum firsthand. Nellie had accepted this offer to go undercover and investigate the asylum, but she didn't believe that there was much of a story there. She, like many others, couldn't imagine that the most vulnerable of society's members were being mistreated. Nellie believed that she would gain entry and see a good life among the insane, but she would soon find out that her beliefs were wrong. Blackwell's Island is synonymous with its abusive conditions, sadistic nurses, and sane women being held against their will, often for the simple reason of not being able to speak English. This is known today because of Nellie. And I'm going to tell you what the prisoners of Blackwell Island suffered through from Nellie Bly herself. So in order to gain entry into the asylum, Nellie had to fake insanity, like I said. And this she knew would not be easy. She had never met anyone with any kind of mental illness, and she really didn't know how they appeared. All she knew was what she read about. All this didn't cause Nellie the most fear. What she was most worried about was she had no idea how she would get out of the insane asylum once inside. She asked her editor how they would get her out, and he said as much, telling her he didn't know, but that they would.
Oh, hell no. Nope.
Mm-mm. Mm-hmm. Yep. He's like, I don't know, but we will.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, with her fear and worries pushed down, she took everything she remembered about how the insane appeared and what she set out to and put on her act. She started this plan at a boarding house for working women. While here, she talked about missing trunks, claimed she didn't know where she came from, and made comments about how everyone looked crazy and you never knew what a crazy person would do. That a crazy person could kill them all and no one would suspect a thing.
Damn.
Eventually, the boarding home owner went to the police to have her removed. They took Nellie down to the courts. Once in front of a judge, Nellie had claimed to never have come to New York, but they were in New York. The judge she stood in front of was worried for Nellie. He believed her to be a lady, and he was certain that someone was searching for her. He himself didn't believe she was crazy. He thought that maybe someone had drugged her and brought her to New York for sinister reasons. So instead of sending her straight to the island like someone had suggested, he sent her to Bellevue Hospital to be evaluated. At Bellevue, Nellie was declared insane as soon as she arrived, and she was ushered off to the insane ward of the hospital. Right after entering the ward, she met a woman named Anne Neville. Anne was not insane. At least it didn't appear as though she was. She had been a chambermaid, but her health had went downhill. So her nephew had sent her to a sister's home to be treated. Her nephew was a waiter, and once out of work, he couldn't pay her expenses. So he had her transferred to Bellevue to finish her treatment. There, they asked many questions, some that had absolutely nothing to do with her illness. Doctors confused her with their repeated questions, and so then she was deemed insane. Anne said she wasn't insane, that her brain was fine, but doctors wouldn't listen, and the nurses were useless.
Damn.
Anne was only the first woman that Nellie would meet that was, in fact, completely sane and trapped inside an insane ward. The first night at Bellevue, Nellie showed a lot. Women who weren't truly insane. The patients there were poorly fed, being given boiled meat and a potato for dinner, suffering through the cold because every window on what they called the insane hall was open. The doctor at Bellevue evaluated Nellie that first night. He asked her many questions that she stated were useless and senseless. He deemed Nellie, quote, positively demented, and says she needed to be put somewhere someone would take care of her. This was the second medical expert that Nellie had been able to trick into believing she was insane. I don't want to go anywhere near these fucking doctors.
No, not at all.
So this gave Nellie much less hope in doctors than she had before. Which, girl, same. At this point, she was sure that if the person wasn't violent, no doctor could truly tell if someone was insane or not. So at this point, she's now starting to be like, okay, maybe you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Right.
So Nellie, most of the days following her evaluation, she spent them observing other patients, the nurses, and so on. In her book, 10 Days in a Madhouse, which you can read on Kindle, Nellie said at 3 p.m. their lunch was served. It was a gruel of broth, which is like thin porridge made from either broth or water, which sounds fucking disgusting.
Yeah.
And then at 5, they were given a cup of tea and bread. The night was no warmer than the day had been. The windows had been closed and locked at that point, but there was still no heat provided other than thin blankets and hard beds with straw-stuffed pillows. Yeah.
How the hell you lay on that?
I don't have a clue, but they were expected to. So Nellie suffered through a sleepless night along with the other patients that were there. The nurses talked and read aloud to each other very loudly. They walked down the hall, looking in on each patient every hour. Occasional yells and cries could be heard from the men's hall, and the sound of the ambulance bringing in more patients was heard all night. But despite all this, Nellie had been able to fool 2 medical doctors, and she survived her first night in the insane hall of Bellevue Hospital. The following day, September 15th, was not much different for Nellie. She was awoken at 7 a.m., and the hospital was colder than the day before. Like, it's September, and they ain't got no heat.
Right. What the hell?
Yeah. Bitch, my heat comes on as soon as it gets cold. Which is usually like the end of August, beginning of September.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck that. It is cold by the end of September. So when Nellie pointed this out, a nurse had told her that they couldn't turn the heat on until October. And that the steam pipes hadn't even been put in for the heat. Like, what, do you take these pipes out and put them back in every year?
Right. That's weird.
I thought once they were in, unless you had to, like, have them fixed.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, they were served what Nellie described as a mess. She was told it was chicken broth, because she said it was a mess. So,
ugh.
I don't feel like it was chicken broth.
No.
After another set of evaluations, patients were served a cup of unsalted beef tea at 10. Then at noon, they were given some cold meat and a potato. Then at 3, they were given a cup of oatmeal gruel. And at 5:30, a cup of tea and a slice of unbuttered bread.
Yuck.
Yeah. I'm not about to eat none of that.
No, me neither, because that all sounds nasty.
Yeah. Like, ugh. The patients at Bellevue were poorly fed, obviously. They were not kept warm. They were told if they wanted to keep warm to wrap up in their shawls and walk the hallway.
How's that going to keep you warm? All the windows are open.
Exactly. Like, I get, like, movement and friction. The windows are open, though.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
No. So, obviously, the treatment of mental health is much different today than it was during Nellie's time. But even for those standards, this is inadequate and horrendous. So at 1:30 on Monday, an attendant arrived. He ushered Nellie and 4 other women, 2 of which were clearly not sane at all, into a wagon, and they left, headed to Blackwell's Island in the lunatic asylum. And it just gets worse from here. Awful. Once there, the nurses and doctors again questioned each woman. We obviously know Nellie was faking her insanity, but there were other women who were not faking and not even insane. Ms. Maynard had pled with the doctors to listen to her, to test her, to give her a chance to prove herself sane. But they ignored her. Mrs. Sanchez was German and could not speak English, nor could she understand it. There was a nurse there, however, that could speak German. And so she, you know, quote unquote, translated for the doctor. But unfortunately, the nurse, who was named Miss Group, that's a fucking name for you. That name right there tells you she's shitty.
Right.
Group. Seemed to be ashamed of her nationality and refused, saying that she only understood a few words of her native language. Bitch, you're from Germany. What the fuck do you mean?
That's fucked up.
The doctor was able to get the nurse to ask the occupation of Mr. Sanchez, but nothing else. She refused to translate anymore. So, you have this poor German woman, and she's destined to be locked away, labeled insane, all because she spoke and only understood German.
That's so wrong.
Yeah. About this, Nellie said in her book, quote, "Can such carelessness be excused? I wonder, when it is so easy to get an interpreter? If the confinement was but for a few days, one might question the necessity. But here was a woman taken without her own consent from a free world to an asylum, and there given no chance to prove her sanity. Confined most probably for life behind asylum bars, without even being told in her language the why or wherefore. Compare this with a criminal who is given every chance to prove his innocence. Who would not rather be a murderer and take the chance for life than be declared insane without a hope of escape? Mrs. Sanchez begged in German to know where she was and pleaded for liberty," end quote.
That's sad.
Yeah. Like, and that's just the beginning of it. That's just day one. Part of day one.
Wow.
Yeah. So before we go more into Nellie's experience at the asylum, I want to give you some insight into the place itself. The asylum was an old stone building built in 1832 after New York City had bought the East River Island in 1828. This place was built in order to physically separate prisoners from the city. The island, however, was not only home for prisoners. The island held many buildings, a general hospital, an almshouse, which is the house built to house poor people, a hospital for, quote, incurables, and for some time, a smallpox hospital. So this fucking island just holds everybody.
Right.
Everybody they don't want in the city, basically. Then in 1839, the lunatic asylum opened and began to accept patients. This asylum was the first of its kind in New York City. Okay, so on this island, we have a prison, a hospital, a house for poor people, and then an insane asylum. Like, what the hell? Why do you need to house poor people on an island?
Right.
Why are you putting an insane asylum on an island by a prison?
That makes sense.
The thought process there. I don't understand it. So in the early 1900s, the last remaining patients on Blackwell Island were moved to other hospitals. And in 1921, the Metropolitan Hospital bought the building. The island was renamed Welfare Island. In 1955, the Metropolitan Hospital moved out of that building, and then it was left empty. And just like nearly all the other buildings on the island, it turned to ruins. Then in 1973, the island was renamed after President Roosevelt. So due to the damage from exposure and fire, most of those buildings, which include what was once the asylum, are unrecognizable. The asylum and other buildings still stand, but have been added to the National Register of Historic Places, which I'm just going to say, I don't feel like this is a place you want to be proud of. Okay?
No, not at all.
Just saying. The asylum, though, stands out amongst them all. It's marked by its octangular tower and is the only original piece of the building that still stands today. Today, the island itself is home to many residents, parks, and more. So people live on this fucking island now. Like, out of choice.
Right. Not me.
I could only imagine the fucking ghost stories from that place.
That's what I was gonna say.
Oh. Okay, so now back to Nellie's story. The windows were built 5 feet from the ground. So 5 feet from the floor. They were barred. The walls were bare white. Soon after arriving, the patients were ushered into a hall waiting to be let into a room for dinner. The hall was cold due to the windows being open. Nellie explained that it was so cold standing in the hall that the patients with her were, quote, blue with cold.
Jesus.
A quarter of an hour after being sent in to stand in the hall, a nurse finally appeared to unlock the door, which led to a stairway where they again were brought to a complete stop right in front of an open window. The next order they were given was to stop by the heater and then get in line two by two. The diving and pushing began to get into line the way that they were told. One, because they're cold and they want to be in front of the heater. Two, they're fucking hungry because they've stood in this cold-ass hallway for like 30 minutes now.
Right.
Like, Jesus. The group was finally allowed into the eating hall, where there were long, uncovered tables lined with backless bench seats. Along the table, there were dressing bowls so close that they were almost touching. The bowls were filled with a pinkish stuff, which the other patients had told Nellie was tea. Next to this, there was a thick-cut piece of butter bread and a snack saucer, which held five fruit. Each item was inedible. There was no sugar or flavor. They had poor-tasting butter. So, Nellie went her first night with no food.
Damn.
Yeah. I don't fucking blame her.
I wouldn't have ate it either.
Nope. I'd be like, I'm allergic to all this.
Yeah, I'm good.
While here, the women suffered through ice-cold baths, then given slips rather than nightgowns or any other type of pajamas. On our first night, Nellie was placed into a room by herself in isolation because nurses said she was noisy. When Nellie asked for a nightgown, she was told that she was in a public institution and they did not have those. That quote, "This is charity and you should be thankful for what you get."
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big slap in the face.
Right, exactly. Like, oh, it's charity. You're just going to get whatever the fuck we hand you.
Yeah.
Like, you're not even treating them like people.
Mm-mm.
So the night went on in this way. The night nurses were loud, walking up and down the hall, opening the door, shining lanterns inside to ensure that patients were in their rooms and alive. Not only did they see these women, some, you know, mentally ill, some just sick, others perfectly fine, to bed wet and cold, but they kept them awake by being loud as fuck all night. After a long sleepless night, the hall of 46 women were woken up at 5:30 in the morning and served breakfast at 7:15, which consisted of cold tea, buttered bread, and a saucer of oatmeal with molasses. Before going into the asylum, Nellie, like many others, believed that the staff had kept the place nice for the patients. But following breakfast, she learned that was not the case. Instead, it was the patients that were ordered to clean the hall, care for the rooms, and the clothes for not only themselves, but the nurses as well. Following this, the women were lined up two by two and taken outside in the cold. Yeah. Yeah. So they're taken outside in the cold for a walk with only a shawl and a hat to keep them warm.
What the fuck?
Like, bitch, it's the end of September. What?
I don't want to go outside for a walk.
Exactly. It's cold. I already got my winter jacket out at that point.
Right.
So at this point, Nellie realized just how many women were on the island. Outside, she saw rows and rows of women all around her, all dressed the same, straw hat and shawl. About 52 of these women who were said to be the most violent on the island were all connected together by a long cable-like rope fastened to a wide leather belt that were locked together around their waist. So, you know how they have, when you have multiple dogs, they have like that waist thing that can go around to your waist and you can attach your dog to it like that? It's kind of like that. So each one of them had like a leather belt that went around their waist that fastened to them. And then it had a cable that went from the front of them and attached to the back of the belt to a woman in front of them.
That's pathetic.
Yeah. These women were all guarded by nurses as though they were inmates, not patients. According to a physician that worked on the island at the time, there were about 1,600 patients during Nellie's time there. And we will never know just how many of those women weren't actually insane. So after this, dinner rolls around and it's the normal waiting for them between 30 to 45 minutes to be served the same cold soup, potato, and meat. But this time, the meat was slightly spoiled.
Oh, yuck.
Mm-hmm. The rest of Nellie's days inside the asylum were exactly the same as I just described. She stated that the food was the worst part most days. I'm going to break down what they ate. Prepare yourself, because it's Gross.
Oh.
I wouldn't even feed this to my dog.
Damn.
For first 2 days, the food had no salt. It had mustard and vinegar on the meat for flavor, but it only made it worse. Then they were given fish boiled in water. Those that refused to eat any of it were threatened with punishment.
Mm-hmm. I would have took the punishment, I think.
Yeah, me too. So, on a regular basis, you know, day by day, this is how they're eating. Meanwhile, the doctors and nurses are eating fresh fruit, meat, bread, all fresh. So, there's like 1,600 women on this island getting sick and starving because of the food quality. Meanwhile, those in charge, they're eating like kings every day.
Right.
It's like, okay, why don't they deserve the same? The mental and physical abuse was unimaginable. Miss Maynard, who I mentioned earlier, was around 70 years old. She was sick and frail. So, of course, the coldness inside the asylum only made her worse. The nurses ignored her, then moved on to mocking her. Then one of the nurses sat on top of her and rubbed her cold hands on her face, chest, and even down her shirt. Then the other nurses followed her lead.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Disgusting.
The physical abuse then moved into life-threatening when a group of new patients arrived and one of them appeared to either have an actual mental illness or she could have possibly been intellectually disabled. Obviously, I'm not 100% sure which, just due to the times that this all happened and, you know, the little knowledge of both. So this girl's name was Urena. She was said to only be 18, but the doctor said that she was actually 33. Not sure. Yeah, I don't know. When this was said, Urena would become angry and eventually upset enough that she would cry, yell, and have a meltdown. The nurses found this out and they terrorized her about this. One day they did this until she cried and yelled about how she wanted to go home and how everyone treated her badly. The nurses scolded her and snapped at her to be quiet. As this continued, Urena grew more and more hysterical until, quote, they pounced upon her and slapped her face and knocked her head in a lively fashion.
What the hell?
And that wasn't even the worst of it.
Oh, God.
Nellie continued with, quote, this made the poor creature cry the more. And so they choked her. This still wasn't the end of this round of abuse for Urena. Quote, then they dragged her out to the closet and I heard her terrified cries hushed into smothered ones. After several hours absent, she returned to the sitting room and I plainly saw the marks of their fingers on her throat for the entire day.
The hell's wrong with them?
Sadly, Urena wasn't the only woman subject to this treatment. Nellie witnessed the nurses assault and abuse both mentally and physically on several occasions. Nellie informed the doctors of the treatment they endured from the nurses, and each time she was brushed off and her concerns were ignored. The patients received a bath once a week.
Wow.
Yeah. Can you imagine the stank going on?
Right.
On bathing, but to be honest, I don't know if I would want that one bath a week. Seeing how they were bathed. I think I would rather sit in my own stank and fill. On bathing days, as Nellie called them, the tub was filled with water, and each patient got in one after the other to be washed. The water was not changed until it became really thick.
Ooh.
They each used the same towel, and their dresses were changed even less, about once a month.
Mm-mm.
So I don't even know if I would want this back.
Yeah, I don't think I would.
I think I would prefer to just be dirty.
Stink. Yeah.
Especially, you're taking a bath. You're giving these ladies baths, but you're not changing their dirty clothes. What the fuck is the point in that?
Right. And you're not changing the water.
There's no point in taking a bath at that point.
Mm-mm.
So after 10 days in the asylum, they released Nellie at the world's behest. Her firsthand report was published on October 9th, 1887. And then later in a book called 10 Days in a Madhouse. Which that's the book that I read. And you can find that on Kindle. Right. Really good. Both the report and the to-come book caused a sensation. This prompted the asylum to implement reforms and brought Nellie Bly her everlasting fame. So this one thing is what gave Nellie her name and everything about her, basically.
Right.
Nellie had a significant impact on the American culture. She had shed light on the experiences of marginalized women, and this went beyond the bounds of the asylum as Nellie ushered in the stunt girl era of journalism. Stunt girl journalism is, although used as a derogatory term, it's used to describe a female investigative journalist in the late 19th and early 20th centuries here in the U.S. This type of journalists typically impacted the issues within the law, labor, and journalism genres. That's what they talked about. That's what they tried to make changes in, which was not something that women back then even discussed. Not your business kind of shit, you know. So during this time, these women like Nellie were employed by newspapers in order to go undercover and investigate factories, mills, hospitals, and other agencies and institutions. These investigations would last from only just a few weeks to a few months, with the stunt girl writing reports while still undercover. So newspapers would bring these women in that men couldn't do because they would be suspicious. Right. But who's going to think a woman is writing something about what's going on? Nobody. And while right. they're undercover, they're writing their pieces and sending them off. So they're being released and nobody knows who was writing them.
That's smart.
Exactly. It's like the perfect thing because none of them think a woman's doing it.
Right.
So although they were doing the same work as male journalists, the term stunt girl was used as a way to refer to the idea that women were doing this type of work. They were doing something bizarre or sensational for the time. Which it was. It was also a way to, you know, to refer and say that these women were both strong, brave, and independent, and that they were breaking out of societal norms, which, again, they were.
Mm-hmm.
So along with Nellie Bly, these stunt girls included Elizabeth Banks, Winifred Black, Ada Patterson, and even more. So along with this new era of journalism, her report on the hospital had raised awareness about mental health treatment. And it led to improvements in these institutional settings, such as larger funding for mental health care, additional appointments for stronger supervision of nurses and other healthcare workers, and regulations to prevent overcrowding and fire hazard. In 1888, Nellie went to her editor and suggested that she take a trip around the world in an attempt to turn the fictional novel Around the World in 80 Days into real life for the first time. A year later, on November 14th, 1889, with only a two-day notice, Nellie boarded the Augusta Victoris, a steamer boat, and began her journey of 24,989 miles. In order to retain interest in the story, somebody would get bored with it, the world organized what they called a Nellie Bly guessing match. For this game, readers were asked to estimate Nellie's arrival time down to the second, with a grand prize that included a trip to Europe and spending money for the trip.
Oh, nice.
Right? During her travels, Nellie went through England, France, where she met Julius Vernet in Ames, Port Said in Egypt, Penang in Malaysia, Singapore. She went through the Suez Canal to Yemen and Aden. Colombo, Hong Kong, Japan, and lastly, San Francisco.
Wow.
Just 72 days after she left from Hoboken, Nellie arrived back in New York. She had traveled the globe alone for nearly the entire trip. Her journey was a world record, even though she would only hold this record for a few months when a man...
Of course.
Right, exactly. Completed this same journey in only 67 days. Because, you know, hell be damned if a woman fucking has a world record.
Right.
Show her up, I can do it better. Stupid. So following this success, Nellie quit reporting and took up a job writing several novels for the weekly New York City paper. Among her work there, she wrote Eva the Adventuress. This series included the real-life trial of Eva Hamilton. So between 1889 and 1895, Nellie wrote 11 novels. A few of these copies had survived, but the rest were thought to have been lost. Until 2021, when author David Blixt announced that he had found all 11 novels in the weekly paper, the London Story Paper. Although Nellie was a strong author, she returned to reporting for The World in 1893. So following her return, Nellie went on to use her celebrity status to get her hands on an exclusive interview with the allegedly insane serial killer, Lizzie Halliday.
Nice.
Yeah. So without going too far into detail, because Lizzie Halliday is on our list to cover, she was an Irish-American serial killer who was said to be responsible for several deaths during the 1890s. And in 1894, she became the first woman to be sentenced to death by the electric chair.
Damn.
Yeah. So I fully plan for us to cover her because her story is insane. So that's all I'm going to tell you for now. So in 1895, Nellie got married at the age of 30. She married the millionaire manufacturer Robert Seaman, who was 73 when they married.
Damn.
Wow. She later left journalism due to her husband's failing health. She went on to succeed her husband as head of the Ironclad Manufacturing Company, which made steel containers like milk cans and boilers. Nellie's husband died a few years later in either 1903 or 1904. I saw both be reported, so it's one of the two. This was the same year that Ironclad began making the steel barrels that was used as the model for the 55-gallon oil drums that we use today.
Oh, wow.
It was rumored that Nellie had actually been the one to invent these barrels, but she's not listed as the official inventor. She did, though, have inventions that have been tied to her name. She received the U.S. patent for a novel milk can and the U.S. patent for a stacking garbage can, both listed under her married name, Elizabeth Cochran Seaman. For a period of time, she was one of the leading women industrialists in the U.S. But due to the negligence and the embezzlement by a factory manager, the Ironclad Manufacturing Company went bankrupt. During her time as the head of the company, she made the welfare of her employees a priority. She provided healthcare benefits as well as recreational facilities. Following this, she went back to reporting in 1911. During this time, Nellie covered the women's suffrage procession of 1913 for the New York Evening Journal. Along with covering the suffrage movement, she wrote about Europe's Eastern Front during World War I. Nellie was the first woman and one of the first foreigners to visit the war zone between Serbia and Austria. She was even arrested during her time here because she had been mistaken for a British spy. Nellie Bly died of pneumonia on January 27, 1922, at Marks Hospital in New York City at 57 years old. She was buried in Woodland Cemetery in the Bronx of New York City. Elizabeth was honored in multiple ways, but it was done so under her famous pen name, Nellie Bly. In 1998, she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. Nellie was only one of four journalists honored with a U.S. postage stamp in a set titled Women in Journalism that was released in 2002. In 2019, the Roosevelt Island Operating Corporation put on an open call for artists to create a Nellie Bly memorial to place on the island. The winner was Amanda Matthews, and in December of 2021, her memorial art piece titled The Puzzle Girl was open to the public. The New York Press Club holds an annual Nellie Bly Club Reporter Journalism Award. That's a fucking mouthful. Say that fucking 10 times fast.
Right.
Award to acknowledge the best journalist effort by an individual with 3 or fewer years of professional journalism experience. In 1946, Nellie was the subject of a Broadway musical by Johnny Burke and Jimmy Van Housen. The show ran for 16 performances. Then, during the 1990s, right? Like, it must have done pretty good to run that long.
Right.
Then, during the 1990s, the playwright Lynn Schleicher, I think that's how you say it, wrote and even toured with her show, Did You Lie, Nellie Bly? A one-woman show about Nellie. In September of 2023, an opera based on Nellie's book, 10 Days in a Madhouse, premiered in Philadelphia. Nellie has even been portrayed in movies and TV series. In 1981, there was The Adventure of Nellie Bly. In 2015, a movie titled 10 Days in a Madhouse was released. And 4 years later, in 2019, Escaping the Madhouse, the Nellie Bly story came out. In 1960, Tales of Wells Fargo featured Nellie in one of their episodes. In 1983, she was featured in the show Voyagers. And then later, in the American Horror Story season titled Asylum, which was inspired by Nellie's story. Nellie was also featured in season 2, episode 5 of The West Wing, and was the subject of 2 separate episodes of a Comedy Central series called Drunk History. Yeah.
Damn.
Nellie cemented her place in history. and forged through her life after her father's passing without self-pity. She pushed herself to accomplish what was considered impossible for women at the time. Her work paved the road for generations of women reporters that came after her and that are still yet to come. She survived in Europe through a war, infiltrated an abusive insane asylum, and traveled the world in 72 days. But her brief 57 years on Earth had taken her through nearly the entire world and changes through the female experience in this country. So the book that I use for one of my sources, as well as the list of Nellie's other books that she wrote, they're all on Amazon. I'm going to put that link in the description for anyone that's interested in reading it. So that's it. That is Nellie Bly's story.
She accomplished a lot.
I know.
That's wild what she went through.
Such a good one. I was like, oh, I have to cover that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's one of those people, role model for your young daughters, okay?
Yeah, most definitely.
When we say pick better role models, here you go.
Yeah, she's the one.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That's it. You got any final thoughts? Anything?
Nope.
Discussed?
No.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week for the episode. Next week, we are at two women to tell you about. So that'll be a good one. All right. As normal, our sources and photos can be found on the Facebook page. That link is in the description. Give us a rate, a review. Make sure you subscribe so you know when these episodes are released. We hope you keep listening and remember to
watch for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.